ships to markets. And essentially, any small producer will lose when you get into large markets. It's just the market dynamic of what goes on. Especially when you get into commodity sorts of crops, because the only way that you can actually increase your income is to maximize production. And when everyone maximizes production, your income goes down. So it's one of these great things in politics where individual logic ends up in a collective disaster. It's kind of the tragedy of the commons thing with producers. And if you follow the history of American agriculture, the key time was the turn of the century, the progressive movement, because between 1880 and 1920, there's a massive transformation in American culture, society, demographics. In 1880, 80% of the population was rural, 20% urban. In 1920, those percentages are reversed. 20% is rural, 80% is urban. And so that's a massive urban migration, rural-urban migration, that absolutely transformed what this country was. And one of the reasons that I study developing countries is often that transformation hasn't happened yet, but it's happening now, actually. And when you look at the kinds of economic forces that are in place internationally, it's forcing small producers, small farmers, to move to the cities. And moving to the city isn't just like saying, you know, I'd like a different venue for my life. It means a complete transformation of your culture. There's one American author who lives in France now, actually, John Berger, who's famous in the art history field for a book called Ways of Seeing. But he wrote a trilogy based on the French peasant, because he lived with the French peasant in the 50s. And the first part are stories and the description of the life of the French peasant, close to the earth, all of the cultural aspects that that come really from the relationship with the earth, with their places, and also the relationships with each other because of how they have to live in that place. It's not just a relationship with the land, it's a relationship with each other and how you live off the land. So that's his first book. It's called Pig Earth, brilliant book. The second book, and the third book I don't completely remember, but the second book is the story of how they get forced off their land, and then the third one is their horrible life in the cities, because they have to live in a city and it's a migration. In India now, Vandana Shiva, who is an activist and a physicist, writes a lot about farmer suicides, because it's not just their job they're losing, it's their way of life. And it's not just their way of life, but it's their fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers. They're the failure on the scale or the ladder of cultural evolution. They're the ones who couldn't do it, and they can't take it, so they kill themselves. So that's the key concept that one has to understand when looking at family farms, local cultures, local agriculture, and the dynamics nationally and internationally, is once you go from providing food for a small market to a big market, then the small guy loses. And it's inevitable in terms of market logic. Do you have any questions on that? Because that's sort of a...
So you're saying that it is from going from moving from the small market to the large market. And what, in developing countries or just globally, what's pushing that? What's making that change?
What's pushing it is free trade. What's pushing it is the World Trade Organization. Americans are also pushing it, because part of the interesting transformation of American agriculture, which has a direct impact on developing countries, is after the progressives lost, then there was this massive migration of farmers, and American policymakers actually became concerned that we would have no farmers. So they actually sent people to Scandinavian countries to study agricultural co-ops, like Ocean Spray is an agricultural co-op that is successfully managed to stay around. But then they put in this sort of perverse system that allows us to keep our lands productive for farming, but then actually engages in massive overproduction. So we overproduce corn, we overproduce wheat, we overproduce all sorts of things. Butter in Wisconsin, they have cheese warehouses. Once I think one of the warehouses caught on fire and molten fiery cheese ran through the streets, kind of a surreal sort of thing. England does the same thing. They have butter mountains. And so all major developed countries subsidize their agriculture because it's part of who they see as who they are. It's part of their nation-ness. Nation being a people, not a state. A lot of people who don't study politics use those terms interchangeably, but they're different for a reason. Japan subsidizes its rice production massively, because how could you have Japan without rice paddies and rice farmers? They wouldn't feel Japanese anymore. Well, as a consequence, as a result of massive overproduction in developing countries, now we have to find markets for those goods. And so what better way to help mankind than to find some starving poor peasants in developing countries and give them food? Aren't we nice people? Well, what we're actually doing is completely undercutting their local economy and forcing their farmers off the farms and into urban centers. So we're doing with our overproduction what large markets did in the United States, a massive concentration of farming production. It was ironic in the 80s, late 80s, there was a Kellogg's commercial for Musilix, where Max von Sydow intoned, if life were as it was meant to be, and then you saw images of a peasant community, you know, a woman with long flowing hair just washed in Breck shampoo, and a couple old guys sitting on a fence chatting with each other. And so we have in us this idea that, wow, wouldn't life be great if it were that way? And that's the peasant way of life, the rural way of life. And the irony is, it's corporations like Kellogg that are actually making that way of life untenable in the rest of the world.
So what's the solution to that?
The solution to this is a turn towards the local again. In the United States, we have CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, which is the communities, instead of purchasing vegetables and crops from large markets, which are produced by farmers who essentially engage in monocropping, corn farmers, for example. There's a Corn Farmers Association, which I think is a little bit of a... It intrigues me how you can be a corn farmer specifically, because to be a corn farmer, and only a corn farmer, really means you're not a farmer, because you're not paying attention to the soil and the stewardship of the soil and the whole system in which you live. So community-supported agriculture is where local communities, at the beginning of the growing season, buy shares paid to the farmer. The farmer now has the capital he needs, and credit is always a problem with small farmers. So he has the capital he needs to plant the crops. Now, in order to serve his client, he has to plant a diversity of crops, which is good for the farm, also good for the client. And often the purchase of the shares will actually engage in some of the harvesting of the crops. But these things are springing up all over the United States. All you have to do is type community support agriculture and find local farms that you can buy shares into. So that's one way of turning it around. Ironically, I heard also a supporter of international agriculture on the radio the other day, where he said that local agriculture wouldn't be embraced by the American consumer because she, interesting, the food provider in this case, he called a she. She really wants grapes and peaches all year long, not just when they're in season. And that really struck a chord with me, because it was glaring evidence of actually how we've completely lost touch of where we are, both in the planet as a whole and where we are specifically. That we want universal access to all goods at all times. And we can't wait for something we have to have it now, and it's part of our have it now credit culture, credit card culture, where we need it now. We can't discipline ourselves to have it, even though when you do wait for it, it's like imagining winter in the middle of the summer. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? You have to wait for it, and it'll be sweeter. Or we're in Santa Fe right now, and August is when green chilies come. You can really harvest a lot of green chilies. It's when the crop ripens. You can get green chilies from greenhouses all year long, but they're not that good, and they're more expensive. Now they're amazingly cheap, and all these people set up their roasting bins outside all the stores in town, and you can drive through the streets smelling this incredible smell of roasting green chili. And part of the reason that smell is so sweet is it only happens once a year. It's like, you know, eating grapes all year long is like saying, wow, every day should be Christmas. But Christmas wouldn't be sweet if it happened every single day. Other solutions. Let me think of other solutions. Or if you have other questions, I can think about other solutions.
You can think of some more if you want, or...